It is a signal pleasure for me to welcome again to the village Congressman Mike McCormick and his wife Margaret. Some of you have already been introduced to Margaret, for she made a presentation here today at 3 o'clock under the general title, "Oh, for the Life of a Congressman's Wife." And I already have received star ravings from this, and some are proposing to run you for Congress, Margaret. Margaret is, of course, a very important component of this team. She's a great campaigner and a very hard worker with Mike. It is well that you know that life hasn't always been easy for the McCormicks. When Margaret was pregnant with her third child, she contracted polio and was told that she would probably never walk again. 8 years later, she, along with the rest of the family, hiked the Cascade Trail. This exposes you to some of the characteristics of Margaret and the family. This is a return engagement for Mike McCormick and Margaret. Our Science and Technology Committee was formed in 1975, and Mike McCormick and Margaret came here to launch our committee on its first meeting just 2 years ago. And when I was back in Washington on one of my trips earlier this year, he told me he would certainly be pleased to come back again, and so we scheduled another meeting of the Science Committee to accommodate his very tight schedule. That happened to be this week. We have been most grateful for his support throughout our tenure here at Holden. I don't think we could ask for any greater support than what we as a village and we as a people have received from our congressman. A little bit about Mike. He looks forward to coming here. He is most grateful for his 5 or 6 hours in which no one bothered him today. It's the most peace and quiet he's had all year. No phones ringing or anything, and he's most grateful for that. He met with us yesterday. He made a number of excellent suggestions, and will be coming back later this year. The whole tailings problem is a real issue, and other items that I will not go into. A little bit about Mike. He attended both the University of Toledo and Washington State University. As he mentioned earlier, he and I were graduate students at Washington State University after the war. Except for a brief stint on the staff of the University of Puget Sound, he spent the majority of his scientific career at Hanford Works, which is one of the largest nuclear establishments west of the Urals. It is in Richland, Washington. He spent his scientific career there as a research chemist. 15 of the years were spent with General Electric Company, and then Battelle Memorial Institute took over, and he was 5 years with them. Simultaneously, he served in the state legislature for 14 years, 4 years as a representative, 10 years as a senator. It was during that time that he was responsible for writing the laws and the rules relative to the siting of energy plants such as nuclear plants, which are a model for many to follow. He is now in his fourth term in the Congress of the United States, representing the fourth district. He serves on two important committees, Public Works and Science and Technology. He chairs the Subcommittee on Energy. The Energy Now incorporates solar, geothermal, wind, and other associated matters. In 1975, he was the Solar Man of the Year. It was interesting, on his coming to Congress, he was He is no doubt has had the most experience and is the best informed person on energy in Congress. He's also one of few scientists there. And because of this experience, in spite of his youth, he was appointed chairman of this subcommittee, I guess the youngest of any important subcommittee chairman. However, the way things go, when he was the authority on energy, people who couldn't spell energy before suddenly realized that energy is very important, so some of the more senior representatives decided that they should have part of the energy package. Mike didn't tell me anything of what to introduce him with tonight, and I'm not going to take up very much time because I want him to tell you, but I wanted you to have this insight into him. I am grateful for his work in our behalf, not only at this village, but also as a congressman from the state of Washington. I regard him as one of the hardest working congressmen in Washington, and others do too. He works very hard along with his wife for our benefit, and he is a source of much knowledge in this field, and it is therefore the reason that we asked him tonight to give us an energy uptake. We're most pleased that you are here, Mike, and to visit with us.
Thank you, Leo. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is always indeed a pleasure to come back to Holden Village. When I talked to Leo several weeks ago about my coming back, he didn't tell me that when I arrived here, he would have already scheduled me to sort of sing for my supper, but I found my name on the bulletin board out there when I arrived, and he was very happy, saying, "You won't mind talking to us, will you?" And you will see that I came unprepared, because I'm going to show you some slides pretty soon, which Rich Kammerer and I put together, and you will see that they are indeed simply prepared on a spur of the moment for this evening's discussion. But I do enjoy this opportunity to get back with you. One of the problems I face is that I don't know for certain what I said the last time, and I don't know how many of you are here, who are here, were here the last time to hear me. So there's a certain element of danger that I may be repeating myself, and for that I apologize. There's also the very distinct hazard that talking about energy is sort of like talking about religion or history or something else. I could stand up here, I suppose, and talk for 6 hours without stopping or repeating myself significantly, just out of stuff that would come to me, all of which would be relevant and interesting to somebody, or rather. And what I have to try to do tonight is sort of skim across the top and report to you on some matters that I think are important, and then leave some time for questions so that I can be talking specifically to your interests. I want to start with a quotation from the Bible with a little bit of McCormick license in it. In the 30th chapter of Deuteronomy, a combination of verses 15 and 19, Moses, shortly before he died, charged the people of Israel as follows: "I call upon heaven and earth to witness against you this day that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing, good and evil. Therefore choose life, that you and your descendants may live." When I was a graduate student at Washington State University, the then new chairman, David Lilienthal, of the newly created Atomic Energy Commission, visited the campus to lecture to the student body on this new and exciting science of nuclear energy. And I remember Lilienthal's address very well, not only what he said, but very especially the way he closed his remarks, because he used that quotation from Deuteronomy: "I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing, good and evil. Therefore, choose life. And I've always remembered those closing remarks because that quotation, to me, has always been an admonition to the world to turn away from the use of nuclear energy for weapons of destruction and towards its use in defeating and overcoming the age-old enemies of mankind, hunger and disease and poverty and ignorance. And this is a bit of what I will discuss with you this evening. A bit about energy, a bit about our energy policies, how they break down, what I think is good and bad about them, a bit about nuclear energy and the breeder. But all this will be quite superficial, and I will leave time for questions. Now, my approach to energy is one that predates my presence in the Congress. I was quite active with respect to this subject area when I was serving in the Washington State Legislature for, that's been more than 20 years now. And it's based on my historic perspective that there is a direct relationship between the standard of living, or if we please, the growth curve for what we tend to call civilization and energy consumption. Because men and women across this world have become more free as they have had more energy available to them to use. One can cite all sorts of other criteria and defend them well. But the fact is that individual and human freedoms have run parallel with energy consumption throughout recorded history. That's a very simple thing if one thinks about it. The first form of energy was simply muscle power that the individual possessed, and then it was extended by the use of tools to give him some additional mechanical advantages, and then he went to slaves. And we have the classic example of what we think of as the Greek city-states, where democracy is supposed to have flourished, but it flourished only for a few. It was built on a heavy underpinning of a large number of slaves. And then came the use of animals, such as horses and oxen, which greatly reduced the workload for human beings in many ways, in plowing and grinding and doing all sorts of other work. And then came wind, and then water power, paddle wheels, such as the wheel we have out here that has been built to use out here as a demonstration, and then steam, first from wood, and then from coal. And then came oil to make steam and then to burn directly. And then came natural gas and ultimately the use of uranium. And this historic perspective is extremely important because we are living in the midst of a dramatic change in the availability of our energy resources. We are living more or less on the downside, we're living definitely on the downside of the slope for the availability of petroleum and natural gas for this country, and we soon will be on the downside of the slope for the entire world. We've had some interesting lectures on geology, and we've talked of millions of years, and I think it might be interesting for us to think just for a moment about the history of the human race, and we want to trace it back to wherever we want to trace it and cast it forward wherever we like, and just in terms of centuries, and just assume it to be a long, flat line of time. There is a blip in that line that goes along like this and goes up and then goes down again. And that blip is about one century, and it represents the time when the human beings on this earth discovered and burned up virtually all the petroleum and natural gas and most of their coal in one century's time. And that's it, like that. Now, my deep concern with this business of the energy crisis that faces us relates to the fact that we need to provide alternatives for petroleum and natural gas, but that we need to do so in an artificial time frame. Normally, it's taken us centuries or major fractions of centuries to phase in a new source of energy, whether it's coal over wood, or oil over coal, or gas, or whatever it happens to be. In fact, nuclear energy now has been phasing in now for almost a quarter of a century. But now we have the problem that as far as our supplies of petroleum and natural gas are concerned, they will, as far as a significant supply of fuel is concerned, be essentially exhausted by about the end of this century. And as President Carter has correctly pointed out, the world production of petroleum will probably peak about 1985, and from then on will be on the downside of that slope. By 1985, according to the best studies we've been able to get, the nations of the world will be competing militarily or bidding economically for oil where there's a shortfall of between 4 and 7 million barrels of oil a day in the world, starting in 1985 and progressively getting larger. When one realizes the total dependence that our entire civilization has on this energy, these implications assume profound proportions. Now, let me say that I have a great deal of respect for all those who are working in the area of conservation and in the use of alternate forms of energy. And I will tell you presently some of the things that I have been doing in these things. But none of this changes the fact that we need huge amounts of energy throughout our Western industrialized civilization today, and nothing is going to change that quickly. We need energy for all the basic necessities of life, for warmth, or even in some cases for cooling. We need it for food, we need it for our agriculture, we need it for our clothing. Whether the clothing is cotton or wool or synthetics, there's a varying degree of energy involvement. In the case of our society today, it's mostly synthetics. Most of us in this room today are wearing primarily synthetics, and they are all of them, if they are synthetics, made from petroleum or from natural gas or coal. Our medicines are based on the use of hydrocarbons from coal or petroleum or natural gas. The same feedstocks that make TNT make sulfonylamide or whatever else you want to talk about in terms of the various drugs. We need prodigious amounts of energy for metals such as steel and aluminum, for plastics, which have become a very real part of our entire society, for our agriculture, which is heavily energy dependent, and no amount of returning to natural agriculture would ever make a significant dent in our agricultural production, our need for fertilizer for our mass production of crops, for cement and chemicals and transportation and paper and glass. All these are heavily energy dependent. And it's important, and I consider it my obligation, partially because of my familiarity with energy in general and partially because of my special expertise, and such as it is in the field of nuclear energy, to try to help my fellow citizens understand something of this so that they can work together to try to help develop responsible energy policies. And it's also a concern for the environment, because it is possible to develop adequate supplies of energy and reduce below today's impact the impact we have on the environment. And it's also because of my concern with eliminating war and anarchy, international anarchy, which got me into politics in the first place, that I am concerned that the people of this country and this world understand what we must do in order to provide adequate energy, because one of the root causes of war clearly will be the need for sources of energy. This has been true and will be true in the future. Now, there are two schools of thought that are competing today in public in this country, and one of them is with respect to what we must do about energy, and one of them is that we should lower our standard of living, that we should sort of go back to Walden. I think this is just fine for those who want to do it, but I remind them that Thoreau at Walden, even in the 18th century, lived alone. The rest of people didn't come out and live with him. They stayed in their more established society, where they had built their homes and their businesses and their schools and their churches and so on. And even then, society was on a course that was separate from going backwards. And lowering our standard of living clearly is not an acceptable social solution. And the second option is keeping our essential freedoms, but modifying our lifestyles realistically and providing enough energy to do so. Now, this can be done. We can have smaller cars. We can have electric cars rather than gasoline-driven cars. This is clearly a sacrifice in terms of our cultural patterns and our lifestyles. An electric car that goes along at 40 miles an hour and won't hold more than a couple people and 30 or 40 pounds of cargo is never going to be a substitute for sex as a 400 horsepower job is that goes roaring off down the highway. It clearly is not the same sort of an instrument. We can cool our houses less in the summertime and warm them less in the wintertime. We can do various things, and we can clearly establish a whole way of living that recycles our energy. We can do these things. But the two things that we dare not do is premise policies on, one, an impending catastrophe. That is to say, well, the whole world's going to blow up anyway, so we might as well go back and live on the land as Thoreau did, and we'll all go out and do this. That's just totally unrealistic. Or we cannot build them on daydreams. We cannot seek magic solutions. Now, one of the problems that we deal with is some ordinary human reaction to a crisis that is very difficult to perceive. The energy crisis, after all, is a matter of interpretation of exponential curves. Most people never live with it or talk about or understand exponential curves. When someone says about the energy crisis, just in this, since I've been here, someone said, back during the energy crisis, and what they meant was back during the embargo, back during the time when we had to line up at gas stations to get gas. But we have a sort of a syndrome about crises that we find ourselves in. And as a public official, as a politician, as a guy who goes out to get votes, I see this happening time after time. And it's a sort of a syndrome like somebody waking up in a drunk tank on Sunday morning. Now, I've never had this experience, I hasten to assure you, so I can't speak from experience, but I sort of set it up as follows. A fellow waking up in the drunk tank on a Sunday morning would open one eye, and he'd look around him, and he'd see where he was, and he'd quickly snap that eye back shut, and he'd say to himself, I'm only dreaming. This can't be real. This is just a nightmare. And I'm going to open my eye again, and I'm going to be home in bed. And I've been dreaming. Now, that's the first reaction that we got to the energy crisis when people started to talk about it. They said, it ain't for real. It can't be. And then the guy opens his eye a second time, and he sees he's still in the drunk tank, and immediately says, those dirty so-and-sos got me drunk. Somebody else did it to me. And it's somebody else's fault. I would never do that. Seeking scapegoats. And today, 4 years after the nation has become relatively conscious of the energy crisis, we are still seeking scapegoats, trying to harass utilities and oil companies rather than seek solutions to produce adequate supplies of energy. And then the third syndrome is the most dangerous one. Because the guy sits there in the drunk tank for a minute and everything's very quiet, he says, I'm going to get up and tiptoe across the room and that door is going to be unlocked. And I'm going to open the door and walk out and nobody's going to see me. And I'm going to walk home and I'm going to get in bed and nobody's ever going to know I was here at all. He's fantasizing his way out of his problems. And so we have that today. People trying to fantasize their way out of the realities that we face, conjuring up magic solutions. And as chairman of the subcommittee that handles advanced energy technologies, I have a constant deluge of letters across my desk with all these fantastic solutions, from perpetual motion machines to secret supplies of energy and inventions of all sorts that will solve the nation's energy crisis. Now, unfortunately, some of these have taken on the dressings of credibility. And so it is that we have people who believe that solar energy will solve this nation's problems. Well, I'm the advocate of solar energy. I was designated, as Leo said, the Solar Energy Man of the Year, because it was my idea to start the Solar Energy program. I am the author of the Solar Energy Heating and Cooling Demonstration Program and all the solar energy research programs. And there are now over $500 million worth of energy research in solar energy. But I can tell you that if we get 3% of our energy from solar by the year 2000, we'll do extremely well. 3%. And I can back that up with all the engineering data anybody wants to investigate. There's just no challenge to that factual information. Now, we tend to try to fantasize ourselves. But after we do that, then we have to come face to face with realities. So I want to talk to you just a couple of minutes about some of these realities. I think we start with the one point where everybody agrees. And that is there's one concept that's universally accepted, and that is that we shouldn't waste our energy, that we should reduce our national energy growth rate. What isn't yet apparent, even to many sincere and concerned policymakers, however, is that the total energy consumption of this nation must continue to increase as far as we can see into the future, even if we establish Spartan conservation programs and even if they are spectacularly successful. Now, the president has proposed, for instance, that we limit our total energy consumption growth rate to less than 2% per year. This would reduce our potential projected energy consumption, would reduce it from 84 million barrels a day equivalent, where it would be if we were not to do anything, just to go on with our present growth rate, our contemporary growth rates, it would reduce it to 56 million barrels of oil a day equivalent. That would be a reduction of one-third. But it's important to understand that reducing our consumption to 56 million barrels, accomplishing the president's goals for energy conservation, would still require that we would double our present domestic energy generating capacity by the year 2000. Even with this most spectacular, successful Spartan conservation program, we must double our domestic energy generating capacity just to make that level, assuming no available imports, or assuming that we're going to be able to free ourselves from imports by the year 2000. Our present consumption of energy in this country from all sources, coal and gas, both domestic and imported, coal, nuclear, hydro, everything else, is about 37 million barrels of oil a day. We import about 9, rounding it off, leaving us with a production of about 28. 9 from 37 gives us 28, one half of our goal of 56 for the year 2000. And I think we start with this, just understanding this basic fact. This is what the energy crisis is really all about. A rational conservation ethic must be the cornerstone of our energy policies, and we should all attempt in every way to conserve energy. It must be a part of our heritage. And I want to praise the president for making energy conservation at long last a highly visible matter of national concern. But I've held months of hearings on energy conservation. This is, along with solar energy and geothermal energy, one of the areas of my responsibility. And I can tell you that the testimony that we get day after day from the best experts in this country and every place, from government and industry and every place else, is that if we can make 20% reduction, we will be doing remarkably well. That's a long way from 33% reduction, and it doesn't leave us with 56 million barrels a day consumption, but a substantially higher figure. And the chances are that we cannot make 56 million barrels a day without serious, unacceptable economic and political disruption in our society and the weakening of our national defense posture. Now, I'll get to this in a couple of minutes and explain to you why I say this, but I think we should understand it. Now, even with a 2% growth rate, however, will certainly be a dramatic shift away from the use of petroleum and natural gas to the production of electricity from coal and nuclear fission. And here the annual growth rate must be about 5% per year just to maintain an overall growth rate of 2% per year as our supplies of petroleum and natural gas decline. This would mean, at 5% per year, doubling our electric energy generating capacity from coal and nuclear by the early 1990s. Now, that is a real challenge. Now, these are the basic facts of the energy crisis. We depend upon petroleum and natural gas, domestic or imported, for about 75% of our energy needs today. And our Western industrialized civilization, as we know it, is inescapably dependent upon this prodigious consumption of energy. We can readily foresee that our supply is threatened, that there's a widening gap between projected and available supplies and reasonably projected demand. And the challenge that we face is to overcome this paralysis that seems to grip us. and to help develop national energy policies and programs to eliminate waste and conserve energy and protect the environment to the optimum extent in every way practical, but also to recognize that we must produce the energy that we'll need in the future. Now, if we do create such policies, and if we implement the programs to carry them into effect, the people of this country can have adequate energy and environmental protection and economic stability and a decent standard of living. But if we fail, the inevitable result will be economic and societal and political catastrophe, both domestic and international. And I mean that literally. I will show you presently the relationship between energy consumption and employment levels, and you'll begin to understand what makes this program so very serious. Now, I want to tell you, before I say anything else, however, just a little bit about what we are doing so you'll have some comprehension of my perspective. Now, if we're going to, we say, first of all, that it takes from 10 to 30 years to get a new technology from the laboratory out into significant implementation, and it's usually closer to about 30 years. And so there's no way that we could put a new technology on, even if it looked good. If somebody made a new discovery for a magic new technology, it will still take 30 years to have significant implementation. And we point out that if in the year 2000 we successfully developed a demonstration plant and built it and operated it for nuclear fusion, which obviously is the energy of the future, and if this were superior and economically competitive, and we started building plants like a large nuclear plant or like a large coal plant, a 1,000-megawatt electric plant at $1 billion apiece, and started building them at one a week, a new plant every week for $1 billion apiece, it would still take us 40 years to replace the existing system that will exist in the year 2000. 40 years at one plant a week at $1 billion a week. Now, this is just because of the size of the system. And this is what we must understand. When somebody says, we have a new technology, I have a new invention, I say, fine, let's use it, but let's not kid ourselves about the impact in the short range. It's not going to bail us out of our problems. But on the other hand, we have to do what we can. And starting about 1972, when I first became involved in this, we started working in these new forms of energy, in solar energy, for instance, where we started with scattered bits of research and development in the National Science Foundation and in NASA. We built that up till we have now funded for next year, for fiscal 78, $368 million for solar energy research and development and demonstration. That's a 900% increase in the last 3 years, and as you see, if you want to start back 5 years ago, it's a tremendously much greater increase. This includes solar energy heating and cooling demonstrations for all sorts of buildings in the country, wind energy, which is part of solar, ocean thermal gradients, taking advantage of the fact that the surface of the ocean is warm and down deep it's cold, and this temperature differential can be used to drive a turbine, and we can put floating barges out around the equator, reducing aluminum, making ammonia, doing various other things that require a lot of energy, biosynthesis of all sorts, bioconversion programs, converting waste to usable fuels, solar farms out in the desert where we have large arrays of mirrors collecting sunlight to generate electricity. All these things are part of our program. In addition to this, there are large demonstration programs. We have funded $100 million for solar energy heating systems for federal buildings and $39 million just to go out and buy photovoltaic cells, which are the solar panels on satellites, which work just beautifully in space, making electricity up there, little silicon cells. They work just beautifully, but they're sort of expensive for us mortals down here on Earth, about 1,000 times too expensive. And so we're just going out and buying $39 million worth of them to put someplace just to hope it brings the market down. This is the sort of thing we're doing, a crash program in solar. In geothermal energy, we've done the same sort of thing. We're now up to $127 million for next year, and all types of geothermal energy sources. And we're going to have about 6 demonstration projects on the line by 1980. In energy conservation, we're spending over $300 million, an increase of over 1,000% in 3 years. This includes an energy conservation extension service, another program that I originated, which has just become law. And Washington State will be a pilot project for that. one of 10 states in the country where we'll have something like the Agricultural Extension Service, but it's for energy conservation, teaching people how to conserve and what to do to make the most efficient use of energy. And the conservation program also includes the electric car program, which is another one of my programs, by which we hope to have, we will, by the year 1984, have purchased about 7,500 electric cars and run them on field demonstrations and then sold them. We expect to have competitive electric cars with small American cars on the streets of this country by the mid-1980s. It also includes a new automotive propulsion research and development program, how to use new fuels and new types of engines for automobiles, because a great deal of the energy we consume, of course, is in transportation. And no matter what we do about it, we cannot reduce that number. In magnetic fusion, which is, as I said, clear to the energy of the 21st century, we've had a 300% increase in the last 3 years, and we're up to about $350 million this year. In the liquid metal fast breeder program, which was going very well, we are funding it completely this year, including money for the Clinch River plant. Now you can see then sort of an energy policy emerging, and that policy is that we must develop all these long-range technologies. We must have an aggressive research and development and demonstration program in every field of energy conservation and production and transmission and consumption and conservation, but at the same time we must recognize the benefits of research and development are long-range benefits, that we must proceed for the future with the energy sources we have available to us today, and those of course are coal, the long petroleum and natural gas, are coal and nuclear fission, and then early on as the next innovation coming in would be the nuclear breeder. Now I want to show you, if I can, some transparencies here that Rich worked out for me. And if we can, do I turn the lights off over here? Beg your pardon? These will probably do our, these are some of Rich's work today, and I very much appreciate it. One of the first things that happened to us when the oil embargo came along was we set up programs with the Federal Energy Administration to conserve on gasoline. And we said, don't buy gas on Sundays, buy gas every other day, don't drive so much, don't drive for pleasure, only for necessity, and so on. And one of the first things that happened was you started getting mail from people saying, hey, you're ruining my business. And it came from gas station operators and from roadside motels and roadside recreation facilities and restaurants and this sort of thing. And so we said, that's interesting. Obviously it's true. We're ruining their business, and obviously we have to do it. But what's the overall relationship between energy and jobs in this country? And we started scouting around, and nobody knew. Nobody had ever asked the question. So we started trying to pull together pieces of information. And this one, the first ones we were able to pull out, just the relationship between GNP and energy consumption. We thought, boy, that's interesting. That sort of whet our appetite. That correlation looked pretty good. So when we have the next slide, we said, what's the relationship between energy, And this is deviation from the trend line on GNP and unemployment. We couldn't get the direct relationship between energy and jobs, but again, you can see a remarkable, and those figures run from the Second World War up to the present time, you can see this remarkable correlation between these two. And we said, well, what's the direct relationship then between energy consumption and just plain civilian jobs? And this is the curve we got. The top one is the number of civilians employed since the end of the Second World War, and the bottom one's the total amount of energy consumed. Now, nobody had ever drawn that curve before. And we said, well, that's interesting. It's not surprising. More people, more jobs, the more jobs, the more energy requirement. We noticed some striking things right away. One of the things that Rich did very faithfully for me on this was to faithfully reproduce those dipsy doodles in that curve. And what this shows is that every time we have a recession, and you can start, every time that top curve dips, you see a corresponding dip in the curve below. And he said, that's remarkable. We can read the economic health of this country on the energy consumption curve. And then we said, look again, beyond 1960, the slope of the energy consumption curve is steeper. Well, why is that? Well, it's because we're using more expensive automobiles, bigger cars, and lower mileage, and that's where a lot of the energy goes, using more gadgets in our houses, And industry now is being challenged by international competition, which requires them to be more efficient, and require them to be more efficient in terms of a dollar per unit product. They use more energy and less manpower. And so those things contribute to that steepening slope. And the right-hand side of the curve, notice how both of them go down with the oil embargo, and both of them come back up as we start out of the recession. Well, this was pretty good stuff, and we thought, let's get it refined a little bit. And so we have the next curve, and this is the one that really brought down the house. Now that is from the end of the Second World War to the present. And the top one is total energy consumption, percent growth, employment, and that's again percent growth, GNP, percent growth. Now all those are raw data, undoctored. Now there you see an absolutely phenomenal correlation. I kid my economist friends, if any one of them had discovered this, they would have been writing books and having laws named after them and everything else. We discovered it first. But this tells you something. Just look at the right-hand side. How in 1 year after the recession, all three of those lines go up together. When somebody says we're going to just dramatically cut down our energy consumption, just remember that we have to first decouple it from employment levels. And we have to think in terms of a wealth-producing employment. And we can all deliberately use less energy and have more jobs. We can decree that nobody will drive their cars more than 10 miles a day, and anybody who's unemployed will take in somebody else's laundry, and so that person will take in somebody else's shoe shining or lawn mowing or something like that, and we'll all be employed and be using less energy. The trouble is, of course, our living standard will go down. And this is the important thing to understand. We can make more jobs consuming less energy, but they aren't jobs upon which our standard of living depends in this country. And they aren't jobs but which produce wealth or produce goods. This is the important thing to understand. So when we say we're going to reduce our energy consumption per capita, we have to remember what we're talking about. It probably is possible to decouple these. But now you see what this says is that there is a direct relationship between energy consumption and employment. And if the energy consumption goes down and employment has to follow it down, then you have the serious social and political unrest that follows. And this is the thing to understand. Now if I may have the next curve. This is McCormick's modification, simplification of what is known as the King-Hubbert curve. Dr. King-Hubbert was a mathematician for the Interior Department who for many years is making mathematical productions on how much recoverable petroleum there is in this country. And he based it on a series of abstract mathematics that I could not understand. And he said it's going to peak out about the it's 1970, and it's going to start down, and it's going to go down disastrously, and by the end of the century, we're going to be in big trouble. He started doing this in the 1950s, and his work was suppressed or ridiculed, even in the Department of Interior, because the oil companies didn't like to hear it. And shortly after the embargo came along, he came to me and said, I've got this information, and it has to get out. What can I do about it? I fortunately have a PhD physicist who is a good mathematician, and he sat down, and he had another friend who's both of them from Caltech, and they got to work on this thing, and they took it up to MIT, and they said, this work is impeccable, this is superior work, and they brought it back to Washington, D.C., and the Federal Energy Office, even before we had an FEA, picked it up, and now it's regarded as being the best model in this country, or the best model there is, for recoverable oil. And the oil companies and the government all subscribe to it. A similar one exists for natural gas and a similar one for world oil, which is a bit higher in the peaks about mid-1980s. Now, I point out to you that we're already started down. Our domestic oil production in this country is down about 12% below its peak, which occurred between 1970 and 1973. We're already well down our domestic oil production. And if you remember that at the peak of the embargo, when the embargo, oil embargo was the worst, we were only being deprived of 10% of our petroleum. We're already down 10%. We're making it up, of course, by imports. But that, of course, makes us vulnerable to all the problems of foreign policy and foreign military affairs and, of course, the trade balance. This year, we're spending $40 billion to import that oil, and it will go up substantially next year. Incidentally, someone said, why don't you find another Prudhoe Bay? and solve your problems. Well, the fact is, Prudhoe Bay, the oil from Alaska is giving us 2 million barrels of oil a day for maybe 20 years. And that would just broaden that line on the right-hand edge of the curve out and make it not quite as bad for a few years. That's all it would do. Okay, may I see the next slide? Now, I said earlier that I talked about making the president's conservation goals. And this curve simply puts that in graphical form so you'll understand a little better, and then I'm going to show you another curve that uses it. What we see here is a curve that runs from 1960 on the left over the year 2000 on the right. And that curve that starts up from about 20 and goes out that little dip in the middle there is what we have been using in energy. That's that same curve you saw in greater detail a minute ago when we had energy and jobs. And that dip there in the middle is the recession we went through following the oil embargo. And then you see where we are in 1976 on that arrow. Now you see these two options. One of them is the business as usual, 3.6% growth rate per year. And the bottom one is approximately 2% per year for the balance of the century, winding up at 56 million barrels of oil a day. I said we would have to double our capacity. Remember that where we are in 1976 there, you have to take off 9 million of that, go down from 37 to about 28 for our present domestic production capacity. Now, this is regarded as an extremely optimistic projection, even to make that 56. Now, let's take a look at where the energy might come from. Now, here's the same curve. The top two lines on that curve are the same lines you saw a minute ago. The top one is business as usual consumption, and the one underneath it that goes out to 56 is our goal for the year 2000. And in between, then, is conservation. That's a total of 28 million barrels a day, or one-third reduction. Then down below is what we... This is essentially what the Carter proposal amounts to, except that they don't publish it. This is just putting the pieces together. And what it amounts to is producing about two-thirds of the oil, domestic oil and gas that we're producing today.
Now, so there you would be from 19, about 19 today for oil and gas, down to about 13. That's the bottom section of the curve. And then imports going from a bit above 8, that shows 8.1. I think it's closer to 9, but that's close enough for our purposes, down to about half. In other words, we're assuming we'd still import half as much oil as we are today, although the White House talks about getting down to 6 by 1985 and then going substantially lower. That 4 I just got out of discussion at the White House with the director of the Federal Energy Administration said, yes, we'll use 4 as a number. Coal is approximately tripling our present production. It really would be a bit over 20 if it were actually tripled, but that 6.8 is now a bit high. It's not going to be that high because of strikes in the coal industry. And we use 19. Now, that's a prodigious effort in terms of manpower. That requires 200,000 new coal miners. If you ever try an interesting experiment, go out and ask somebody if you can hire him as a coal miner. It's a real interesting experience in psychology. I've done this with college kids, some of whom were complaining about the safety of nuclear power plants, and I asked them how many would sooner work in a coal mine and live beside a nuclear power plant or work in a nuclear power plant. They wouldn't extend their hands. The fact is, tripling our coal production is going to be a tremendously difficult thing, and of course it has very large, serious environmental problems, both to mine it and to burn it. The next is hydroelectricity, that band that runs all the way across and comes out of two. That's simply developing all the hydro sites we're going to develop in this country. We're not going to burn Hellstrom, and we're going to burn the New River, but...
What we're going to do, the maximum would give us about 2 million barrels of oil a day equivalent. And then skip nuclear for a second, and above that, we put in a very generous estimate for solar and geothermal and waste recycling and this sort of thing, and that comes out on that curve, and I can't read it from here. It comes out, so I'm sure you can't either, it comes out 5 million barrels of oil a day equivalent. That's virtually zero today. Now, that curve would leave us with about 400 nuclear power plants, like the Trojan plant or like the ones being built at Hanford or the ones we build over at Skagit. The typical 1,000 to 1,200 megawatt plants would require about 400 nuclear power plants by the year 2000 on the line. Any slippage in any other area of that graph would require more nuclear power plants. And we have uranium fuel for about 300 at the most. All of our known and probable reserves of uranium give us enough fuel for about 300 plants. So even given the most optimistic projection for the year 2000, we don't have enough uranium fuel just to close the gap, even if we assume we still import 4 million barrels of oil a day. And of course, that's the rationale behind the nuclear breeder program and why we are pushing ahead with that, because with the breeder, we have an unlimited amount of nuclear fuel for the future, and we can then build more nuclear plants if we have to. Now, the decision on the breeder would not come until about 1990. I should point out to you that every other country in the world is going through the same rationale, that the French and the British and the Germans and the Russians and the Japanese are already far ahead of us in the breeder program. They all of them have operating demonstration programs much bigger than anything we have. The Russians and French are about 12 years ahead of us in the breeder program. And yet, of course, they are also going ahead with fuel reprocessing. This is a debate that I and others have been having with the President. Frank Church and I have been on one side of the question, and President Church is on the other. President Carter is on the other. And we fully expect that the Congress is going to go ahead and fund the breeder program and fund nuclear fuel reprocessing. Well, I talked longer than I expected to or wanted to, and I still have a lot I didn't say from my notes. But I wonder if I may just stop here and give you a chance to try to ask questions, and I try to answer them. That there are many things we could do that would reduce our energy consumption and would literally take out of common usage a lot of material things that people think of today as being certainly at least desirable. They're either desirable or status symbols, or some people consider them as essential. That's part of that one-third in the conservation program in the top. For instance, going to smaller automobiles is something I think is absolutely essential. We are going to do that by law. This is not just a matter of trying to coerce people. We are coercing or entice people. We are coercing the automobile companies. We are saying that by 1980, the average of each of the automobile companies, all their automobiles, the average mileage must be 20 miles per gallon. By 1985, it must be 27.5 miles per gallon. And that they simply have to meet that goal. And if they have to make nothing but smaller cars to do it, that's the way the ball bounces. If they can get a better car with a more efficient engine, that's fine. I think the same thing applies to a lot of other things. Unfortunately, there are many persons who think that their standard of living is measured by how many chrome-plated or internal combustion gadgets they can put in the garage. Every once in a while, I pass somebody on the highway in a camper hauling a trailer with a boat and two Hondas. And sometimes there are two motors in the boat, one for racing and one for trolling, or one for water skiing and one for trolling. And I say to myself, this must end someplace. And clearly it must. There is a severe problem, however, in how one attacks that problem. It's going to be very difficult to say to people, well, you may not have anything except essential vehicles. There are people in Congress now who are trying to eliminate all off-road vehicles. One of them made this proposal. He was after something. I don't know exactly what he had in his mind, but I immediately said to him, great, I'm against the Indianapolis race and all other racing events in the country. Do you agree? And he was petrified that he would get tagged with being against automobile racing. And he immediately withdrew his request. Now, this is some of the problem that we have to deal with. There is no doubt about the fact that we must change our style of living. We must conserve more. We must build houses that are energy-conserving houses. Our industries must convert. Industry is ahead of the rest of us because it's been an economic thing with them for a longer period of time. But there is a problem that we get into someplace when we start costing jobs. There are basic industries that are fundamental to the entire structure of Western civilization: steel, aluminum, glass, concrete, paper, and so on. And we can make them as efficient as we possibly can, but we still must have the materials. There are, and we could say, you know, nobody can have automobiles, we can say, turn out every other light bulb. That reduces the number of light bulbs that can be made. That takes people out of the job, out of a job. The implications, the social and political and economic implications of this sort of thing, are severe and far-reaching and difficult to analyze, and they must be approached very carefully. Going back to what I said, it's a difficult problem of semantics and interpretation and communication. I think we all want to move in that direction, but we must recognize what the limitations are. And so when I say we dare not reduce our standard of living, I'm thinking one thing. I hope you're thinking the same thing. There are some very good studies that have been done on this now, some very intelligent and responsible studies, and they point out basic differences. First of all, this country is a very much bigger country, and Canada is too. People simply drive a great deal further on the average anything they do, for everything we do. Secondly, by and large, much of the country is very much newer than Europe. Europe has been for generations with mass transit systems of various sorts, rails and various systems by which people have established themselves close to their jobs. Their houses are close to their jobs, they're close to their shopping centers, and they can use these systems. So they don't use automobiles nearly as much. Thirdly, the number of floor space, the number of square feet of floor space per house in Europe is generally much lower than it is in the United States. We're talking about all the people in Europe and all the people in the United States, not just selected groups. And so we have much more floor space. Thirdly, or whatever the number of my items are, the next one is that we have developed a society where cheap energy was available. And so we built big houses that were not insulated particularly. And so now they're using this energy, and we have to go back and pick this up. The basic thing, and there's one other one, that is, of course, much of Europe's industry was destroyed in the war, and it's much of it is newer, and therefore it's more energy efficient. That's particularly true of the steel industry. Now, these are the basic reasons, not because we're profligate in our waste of in our consumption of energy, but simply because we have a slightly different heritage in a much bigger country. And of course, the bigger country calls for bigger cars, because we're driving much greater distances at much higher speeds. We want more comfort and more safety. I should like to point out to you that if you take the United States and break it up into sections, you have places that are much better than Switzerland or Sweden. New England, where all the industry is left. They've just gone someplace else because labor rates were so high. And New England compares very favorably with Sweden or Switzerland. On the other hand, you take areas like Pittsburgh, and it's very bad. They're using a lot of energy making steel. And I do the same thing in the state of Washington. In the state of Washington, I have Vancouver and Wenatchee with aluminum plants in them. Their per capita energy consumption is horrendous. I can take other areas, such as the apple raising orchards in Yakima County, and the energy consumption would be comparatively lower. I think that the president did us a good disservice in putting as much emphasis on this as he did. I think that it's well for us to analyze our problems. And I think it's well for us to understand where we're weak and strong and what we can do. But I think this generalization was a disservice. And that's my response to your question. I'm glad you brought it up, though. I appreciate it. Nuclear energy is a minute fraction of the damage that we're doing from dozens of other ways, including especially the burning of coal, which has far more impact on the environment than all the nuclear plants, including potential disasters. I mean that very seriously. I point out to you that we have now more than 300 operating reactor years in this country and about the same amount overseas. We never had a single person even injured from a nuclear power plant, from any nuclear accident, any nuclear power plant. An employee or a member of the public. There's never been a single person even injured from a nuclear power plant. The calculated risks from a nuclear power plant are literally about the same as being struck by a falling meteor. Now, that's not a figure of speech. It is a calculated number. We can calculate the chance of one of us going out here in that volleyball court tonight and being hit in the head with a meteor. That is a finite number, and we know what it is. And we have spent tens of, well, we spent $4 or $5 million and tens of thousands of well, I would say 10,000 man years, thousands of man years of research on not only making nuclear plants safe, but analyzing the potential danger from a nuclear power plant. And it comes out just about the same as being struck by a meteor from any one person or for any group of persons. I think you must understand that the types of accidents that can happen to a nuclear power plant, even the very remote ones, involve the very worst kind of an accident involves the loss of coolant to the core. And even if there is a loss of coolant, there's about 1 in 100 chance that there would be a meltdown of the core. And even if there's a loss of coolant, there's about 1 in 100 chance that someone would be harmed. Even if you melt down a reactor, there's about 1 in 100 chance. You'd have, statistically, 100 meltdowns to harm a single person. Because that's the way nuclear power plants are built. They're built with all this defense in depth. And I can assure you that you're safer living at the gate of a nuclear power plant than you are driving wherever you drove to get here just one time. You know, we kill 34,000 people a year on our highways, and we burn to death about 12,000 people, and we have 19,000 people murdered, and we go on and on and on with all these hazards. And not a single person, not one person has ever been harmed from a nuclear power plant anywhere in the world from any nuclear accident. I think this is what we have to get into context. Let me just speak about the radiation level, by the way. There is a great deal of concern about radiation from nuclear power plants. What's the elevation here at Holden? 3,500 feet?
32.
Well, staying here at Holden for a week, as compared to living in Seattle or Portland or Vancouver for a week, is more. You get more radiation here than you would at the gate of a nuclear power plant for a year. Now that's just because you're up higher above sea level and you're exposed to more radiation. Let me give you some figures. The gate of a nuclear power plant, you get about 1 millirem per year. Now that's a unit of exposure. A radiation exposure. By contrast, with an average X-ray, you get about 70 millirem. One X-ray gives you about 70 millirem. Living at the gate of a nuclear power plant, you get one. If you fly across the country in an airplane, a jet plane, you get, I guess, about two, three, four, something like that, millirem, just one flight across the country. If you own a Coleman lantern, and it's in your basement, or if you live in a wooden house and a wooden garage and it's in your garage, you get four times as much from that lantern as you would at the gate of a nuclear power plant, same length of time. The thorium on the mantle is radioactive, and it gives you more radiation. And of course, just living at a high altitude, it gives you a great deal more radiation. You've all seen the pictures of Grand Central Station in movies where people are getting off trains or taxis and so on, and greeting each other at Grand Central Station. That entrance, the main entrance on Vanderbilt Street, is made of granite. It was mined at a place called Millstone, Connecticut. And that happens to have a significant quantity of uranium in it, not a lot, traces of uranium. And the radiation level at the Vanderbilt Street entrance is 500 times higher than at the gate of a nuclear power plant. It's 500 millirems per year there at that newsstand. Now, I don't say this to put you down. I appreciate your fears of nuclear energy. I'd like to point out to you that we have today, across the world, probably, 20,000 of the world's finest scientists in nuclear physics, nuclear engineering, geneticists, physicians, veterinarians, every conceivable kind of scientist, who are living and working on nuclear projects, raising their families in the shadow of nuclear power plants. Now, when Leah and I were at Hanford, there were about 2,000 people there with advanced degrees. We had nine nuclear reactors there. None of them, one of them is a dual-purpose reactor. It makes plutonium for weapons and also makes energy, electricity. We had nine nuclear reactors operating there and two big chemical separations plants and a plutonium fabrication facility and a whole bunch of research facilities. And the river ran right through the Hanford Project, the Columbia River, and somebody wrote a statement that it was the most radioactively polluted river in the world. And we talked it over and allowed that very likely it was. It had probably more radioactive activity than any other river. And yet we knew what the levels were. And we spent our summers there on that river, water skiing and swimming and scuba diving and fishing and eating the fish and camping and living on the river. Now, those are the people that understood this business the best. Now, I can tell you that I don't think any one of them would have deliberately lived there and risked the lives of his family if there would have been any hazard. I can tell you that today's nuclear power plants are orders of magnitude safer than those reactors at Hanford were. There's much different as a 747 was from a Model T. And I can only assure you that if you study it enough, you will find that nuclear power plants are simply extremely safe neighbors to have. And the chance of catastrophe is so small as to be well worth it. Yes, the gentleman back. I've been waiting for that question all night. I spent a chat during earlier services this evening. I made myself a training aid. The waste from a nuclear power plant will be turned into an inert glass, like Pyrex glass, about the same chemical makeup and the same inertness. Now, the way this works is that when in a nuclear power plant, the fuels are made up in bundles of little tiny fuel pins, we call them, that are about like large soda pop straws, about the same diameter as a soda pop straw, a big one, and about 10 feet high. And those are all little beads about the size, or pellets about the size of an eraser off a lead pencil. And they're made of ceramic uranium oxide or uranium and plutonium oxide, already in a ceramic form like a glass bead, only they're black and rough. And they're put inside this tube, and then it's welded shut, and then you put a bunch of these tubes together until you have a bundle about this big a square and about 10 feet high, and the thing weighs hundreds of pounds. And that, you put about maybe 150 of those together in the reactor's chamber of a nuclear power plant. And the reaction that goes on there under controlled conditions will heat the water to make steam, to drive a turbine and generate electricity. Now, after about a year in the reactor, these fuel elements are pulled out. Now they're very radioactive because they have all those fission products in them, and they're very, very radioactive, and if they'd shine on somebody without shielding, they'd kill them. And so they're pulled out in a heavy shield, and they're stored in a water basin, like a swimming pool, right down inside the nuclear power plant. And they're allowed to sit there for as long as you want, whatever is convenient, 3 months, 10 years, whatever is convenient. And they simply slowly cool down, never cool enough to be safe to handle without shielding, but the radioactivity does come down very fast, and after a year, they're only a tiny fraction, 1 or 2% of what they were when they were taken out of the nuclear plant. Now, from there, they'll be put in very heavy casks. If they go in a truck, they're about 50-ton casks. If they go on a railroad, they'll be about 100-ton casks. And there'll be one or two or half a dozen of these fuel elements in a cask. Each fuel element is put in an aluminum or a steel can and sealed shut. Just fits that one. And then they're put inside this cask, all remotely, of course, and bolted shut. And these casks have been tested by flying them at 100 miles an hour into brick walls and everything else just to be sure that they will maintain their integrity. And then they're taken to a reprocessing plant, such as the plants at Hanford, which will have one plant operating for a military program next year, or the plant in South Carolina, or plants overseas. They'll be taken to one of these plants, and these are very heavily shielded chemical processing systems. And the fuel elements are handled remotely, and they're chopped up in little bits with a chopper. This minces them up in little pieces, and then they're dissolved. And so you have now a pot of what we call dissolver solution. It's dissolved fuel elements. And that runs through a series of chemical steps that brings you out at the end with one stream, which is fuel for the next cycle. That's a mixed uranium and plutonium. And incidentally, it won't work in a weapon. It cannot work in a weapon. It's a blend that makes it impossible to work in a weapon. It only works in fuel elements. And it's a liquid stream that will go into another plant to be made into new fuel elements. And the wastes are also in a liquid stream. And they go into a different plant where they are solidified, like a lime in a lime kiln. They'll be sprayed in what we call a rotary, the spray rotary calciner, and reduced to an oxide form of gray powder. And then they'll be mixed with borax and silica, sand, and melted to form a glass. Now we're doing this over and over again down at Hanford right now, and tomorrow, today is Thursday, tomorrow they'll be doing a pour at Hanford of that glass as a demonstration for some visiting congressmen will be there, and they'll be pouring it into a canister a foot in diameter and 10 feet high. And that glass then will be poured in there, and it will solidify, just like Pyrex glassware, and be welded shut. Now, a normal nuclear power plant produces 10 of those canisters of glass per year. Now, the glass is 10 to 20% radioactive material. The rest is inert stuff. But all the plants in this country put together today would produce 2 of those canisters a day. That's all the waste for all the nuclear program. And as our program grows for the rest of the century, that will, of course, get bigger. And your share as a human being in this country for the entire nuclear program for the all the rest of the century is 4 cubic inches. That's what I made my training aid for. There it is. There's 4 cubic inches. That's what one person's share of all the nuclear waste from all the nuclear program in the entire nation for all the rest of the century combined, if we have those 400 to 600 nuclear plants in the line my chart showed. Now this glass, of course, in these canisters, we buried very deep in stable geologic formations where there's nobody I've ever heard talk about getting it into the biosphere. Now, that's a story on nuclear waste. Actually, it is one of the simpler of technologies. The French are doing this now on a production basis. And it's simple compared to a lot of the other technologies we have. Now, it doesn't mean that there's nothing to worry about, nothing to it. It doesn't mean that we don't have a lot of other bugs that we have to work out. But the handling of waste is not an insurmountable problem. We've been doing a very good job of waste handling for the last 30 years in the military program. We know a great deal about it.
The question is about mass transportation and its relation to the use of energy.
We are putting quite a bit of money now. I can't tell you exactly how much. We're putting quite a bit of money now into mass transit systems. From now on, they're going to be on rubber tires, not on tracks, because we find the track systems are too inflexible and too expensive. But we are putting money into a number of programs for mass transit throughout the country. Part of the gas tax that we voted down the other day would have gone for mass transit, by the way. The rest would have gone back to the states. I think mass transit is very important. Once we establish it in a community, then people, when they buy houses, will tend to live so that they can use it conveniently. And there's great difficulty in getting it accepted, so we have to operate with it for a time, sometimes at an inefficient level. But we are moving in that direction.